talk a little bit more about the NHL draft lottery, but also a lot of other things as well. Chris Johnson, our Monday NHL insider, joins us now. Chris, how are you?
I'm happy to hear you guys seem to have the correct take here, because that was splendid the way that turned out.
Oh, it was from an entertainment value point of view, where you know the teams that are out of the playoffs, didn't make the playoffs, they're going to be invested in the draft because the future, you know, that's their hope, right? But yeah, with the play-in series, the level of intrigue now, where you're both watching the draft and you've got all these markets engaged going forward, from a business point of view, it's a pretty genius move, isn't it?
Well, and you're going to get a second lottery at the end of all this, which, you know, will be another must-see TV event. And I recognize you've only got a 1-in-8 chance. I mean, it's better than no chance, but it's still long odds for the 8 teams that don't get through the play-in round in order to get Alexi Lafreniere. But, you know, I think it worked out well. You know, this is a league, if you look back 5 years ago or so, give or take, you know, they'd actually made the odds even worse for the last place overall team, or less likely for that team to pick number one overall. They really wanted to disincentivize tanking as much as possible. And, you know, it's called a lottery for a reason. It just turns out this is the 1 year that Team E in the placeholder teams with 2.5% odds actually won the first overall pick, because no team in the previous years when, you know, were assigned those actual odds has ever come from that far back to win it. But, you know, this is always a possibility. And I think that the league is very comfortable with it playing out this way. Yes, for the entertainment and the buzz it creates, but I think also just from a competitive standpoint, I think the message is going to be that, you know, they don't want teams intentionally finishing last trying to do this. And I guess, you know, there might be some debate about that, but given how important, you know, franchise type players are, and that you typically only get those players in the first few picks of the draft, and you know, Vancouver has been fortunate to get two of them, it appears, you know, without picking first overall, but largely the type of guys we're talking about are only go number one overall. I mean, it's a valuable pick, and I think you have to make it as random as possible while still respecting the standings.
Chris, what's the reaction been, not just from the league office, but from teams around the league? Has there been any, you know, renewed calls to maybe change the system a little bit, you know, from teams that might be disappointed that they didn't end up higher up in the draft order?
Not that I've heard. You know, I don't sense there's a lot. There's a lot of sentiment for that. I mean, obviously, I'm sure there's some disappointment if you're a team like the Red Wings or the Senators, especially Ottawa. You happen to have two of the top three odds to pick number one overall. You know, Detroit had a historically bad season. I mean, but, you know, some of that is just you're more upset at, you know, at the way it's turned out for your franchise, as opposed to thinking the system itself is broken. You know, I think if anything, you know, what we've seen a push for and some talk in executive circles is, you know, doing it some way where teams that get a high percentage of either number one overall picks or say top three picks, you know, limiting that. And so maybe where we might get that chatter is if the Oilers were to lose their play-in series and, you know, end up winning the number one overall pick just because they've had so many first overall picks in the last decade. I mean, I could see that triggering a real change. But beyond that, I think most people understand that this worked exactly the way the lottery is designed. I mean, we had such a strange year because we didn't have the identity of those teams 8 through 15 to have combinations put into this lottery. But, you know, this worked as it's supposed to. And I think, you know, my sense is that the league's very comfortable with how it goes. You know, I think that the thinking is there is so much parity, and I know that's a beat around phrase, but the idea is that, you know, you got to be careful rewarding you know, just the team that finishes dead last. I mean, that there's not a whole lot between teams. And, you know, I think that this is going to be pretty exciting. I mean, most fan bases are going to want their team to win, obviously, and play playoff games. But in the event you end up losing in that play-in series, there's at least a potential soft landing on the other side of it.
Well, Chris, you know Vancouver well. And over the weekend, the conversation that dominated was, what's more valuable, winning a round or a chance at a potential franchise player? I just got to check with you. Are these conversations being had in other markets as well?
Yeah, well, Montreal, for sure. I mean, the difference, of course, is that the Canadians in no world were even in the playoff picture until all of a sudden we get coronavirus pandemic and 24 teams in the playoff instead of 16. You know, whereas I think Vancouver is further ahead and you know, obviously had a competitive season, was probably going to be playing playoff games, although we won't know because of those last handful of games that weren't played for sure. you know, it wouldn't have had any chance to win the lottery. Whereas, you know, I think this season in Montreal was far more about winning the lottery. So, you know, there is that kind of discussion happening. You know, I'd still rather see your team win the play-in series and get that experience. I mean, I think there's a lot of value to that. You know, we don't see very many teams, you know, make the playoffs and win a Stanley Cup really quickly. I know the Blackhawks did it in their second try in 2010 after, you know, going to the conference final in 2009. But, you know, for the most part, there is a bit of a learning curve to playing, to understanding how you need to play in the playoffs. And, as much as obviously I'm not trying to diminish the talent of Lafreniere, whoever gets him is going to be doing cartwheels in front of their building. But, you know, I think just because it's only a 1-in-8 chance that if you're looking at this realistically, you'd rather see the Canucks get by the Wild and play in another round after that and, you know, hopefully four more and, you know, take the certainty that's on the table here rather than another lottery.
And Chris, moving on from the lottery, today the league announced that 15 players have tested positive in the course of their phase two protocols out of about 250 that had been participating. What was your reaction to this news from the NHL today?
Well, my personal reaction is that it seems like not a crazy number, but I mean, let's face it, we're still at a point here where we don't have really a clear picture of what the rate of infection is for the NHL population. You know, the tests announced today, you know, are for a little bit more than 250 players that have been doing, been part of the stage two protocol, the voluntary small group workouts. They're getting tested at least twice a week in that protocol. And so you have a rate of roughly 6%, you know, 15 positive tests out of 250. You know, it's going to take, you know, more than 750 players to resume this season. So that's only representing a third of what the entire NHL population is going on right now. And so, you know, I'll be curious to see where that percentage lies, you know, if we get to training camps and everyone's brought into the system and tested regularly. But, you know, those numbers don't set off a crazy number of alarm bells for me. You know, I don't want to be accused here of, you know, just saying, oh, this is nothing, because certainly any case of coronavirus, even for young athletic people, can be, you know, have some real disastrous effects. And that's, I'm not just talking about death. I mean, even for people that live with it. So, you know, I'm not trying to diminish what this means, but, you know, if you look around, especially in the United States, I mean, it would just be naive to think that no one's going to get this just in the course of their day-to-day life right now. And so, you know, the numbers aren't too alarming given the circumstances we're in, but I'm very curious to see what happens here the next few weeks as we get more and more players in being regularly tested. You know, can they control an outbreak within a team, for example, if someone does produce a positive test? And, you know, ultimately, I think as much as some of the agreements and things that need to be reached here, you know, that's going to determine whether or not they can go ahead and have the playoffs.
And the latest being reported from Patrick Johnston of the province that players can begin voluntary workouts at Rogers Arena starting tomorrow. So looking ahead to the conversation, I know last week there's a lot of discussion about the hub city and the news that Vancouver is out, but where does that situation currently stand right now as far as, if not Vancouver, then who?
Well, it continues to move quite rapidly. You know, I've been told that in the last day or so, there's been a lot of conversation on it and that there's another call scheduled for later tonight, you know, after this. And so it's not finalized. You know, I do think that there is at least a possibility both Toronto and Edmonton could each end up as a hub. I'm not certainly saying that's definitely going to happen, but, you know, I think that there is a degree of concern with the amount of cases and how things have spiked in the United States. You know, Vegas all along, you know, has probably been the number one contender. If we had a rolling, you know, power rankings list, you know, going back 14 or 15 weeks, you know, Vegas would have been at the top of it. But, you know, I'm not sure if in the end, you know, we're going to see games played there just because Nevada is one of the places that has had to deal with a lot of cases. There's a real strain on the local medical system, health system. And so, you know, where we're at right now is that nothing's been decided, but, you know, we're in the week right now where I do think they have to declare one way or another where they're going, reach the necessary agreements, you know, put things in place. And I just get the feeling more than anything that, you know, we might end up seeing two Canadian cities after all this end up playing host to these games just because the situation is far more stable in our country. And I do think both the Alberta and Ontario governments have shown a willingness to do things that the BC government wasn't comfortable signing off on in order to allow the NHL to come and play in those cities.
You're listening to Reach Deep. We're joined by Chris Johnston, as we are every Monday. Chris, in Major League Baseball, we've seen players today announce that they're opting out. They don't want to come back this season. Mike Leake, Ryan Zimmerman, just to mention a few. From an NHL player point of view, we've seen other players, you know, flying to Vancouver, for instance, the Vancouver Canucks players. Is there any sense that certain NHL players may want to sit it out, or is that, you know, focused on other sports right now, do you think?
No, I think that it's a possibility. You know, certainly there have been players I know on the NHLPA calls that have been being had pretty regularly here, updating everyone on where things are at, that have, you know, raised some concerns about safety, about their own situations. And I do believe, as part of the agreement, the NHL and the NHLPA are you know, in the midst of finalizing right now, that you're going to see some kind of language in there that allows certain players, especially those with underlying health conditions, to opt out without any penalty. And even those that don't have health conditions, I do believe, will be allowed to opt out, and there'll be some kind of financial penalty for not playing, you know, much like the NBA's implemented. But there will be a way for them not to play. No one's going to be made to go into this kind of circumstance without, you know, having some way to opt out of it if that's what they want to do. And so, you know, my sense is that we will see some. I don't think it'll be a huge number of players, but, you know, it's hard to know until that language is finalized, till we know exactly what the penalties are, and until I think even the players get a chance to get a full look at this document. I know there's been a lot of talk in the abstract about what the bubble looks like, for example, but, you know, until you have the two cities nailed down, you can't tell, you know, a player for the Canucks, this is the hotel you're staying in, this is what your morning and your afternoon looks like, this is what a game day looks like. And so I think players need a lot more information before they can make that choice. And as a result, we don't know for sure who's going to opt out or opt in. But, you know, I would think, you know, given how serious this is, and obviously we have a lot of fathers that play in the league that might have to think about their children, which, you know, from what I understand from Ryan Zimmerman's choice was, you know, partly due to a family health issue that you know, he felt was more important than playing. You know, I would think that we'll see something similar in the NHL, but you know, I don't think it's going to be a huge, huge number of players that go that direction if they're able to play. But we're going to have to wait and see.
CJ, you mentioned there that these negotiations are still ongoing. Of course, it's not just about the hub city and the bubble protocols. It's also the CBA discussions that are happening. What's the latest you're hearing about those talks? And when do you think players might be able to actually vote on these joint proposals?
Well, the hope is to get the voting process started before the end of the week, you know, and as far as I know, they're still on pace for that. Although, let's face it, they're really taking on a lot here. I mean, it's one thing that we can almost joke about how long the hub city conversation has gone on, but that's reflective of the amount of details that are involved in negotiations and all those types of things. And then on top of that, you put the specific rules that will govern, you know, what life in those bubbles look like. And obviously the players have wanted to have a say in what that is. So there's some degree of negotiation involved. And then you're tacking on, you know, an extension to the collective bargaining agreement, which, if you look at the history of the NHL, has not been pretty favorable the last 20, 25 years. I mean, usually that requires, you know, a lockout or a strike in order to reach an agreement. And so that you're packing all that into this period in everyone's lives here where we're all dealing with, you know, I think more unpredictability or uncertainty than would be normal. I mean, it's an ambitious plan. I think in some ways the circumstances of everything going on in the world and the challenges to the business have maybe made it at least slightly easier. And I use that carefully, that term, to reach agreement on some of this stuff, because, you know, I think the owners and players, you know, recognize that working together is probably the best way to navigate the choppy waters at hand. But, you know, the CBA, from what I've heard, we're really talking about a framework or an outline, you know, maybe call it a memorandum of understanding, but, you know, key terms and key aspects of it will be agreed upon. I think that they're very, very close on that, if not completely done. And you know, the hope anyway is that can be put to a period where NHL players can, you know, read through it and get an understanding of what's going on, and then, you know, vote, which, you know, will take another couple of days once that actually commences to do so. And let's face it, time's of the essence, because obviously what's contingent on that vote is the start of camps, You know, July 10th is still the official start date, but teams have been told to prepare for the possibility of July 13th, which is 2 weeks today. And, you know, so they have to get all this done, you know, forever, all the other kind of steps to fall behind for the return to play. And so that makes this probably the most critical week that we've seen so far since the coronavirus pandemic kicked into the league in terms of everything that needs to happen in order to try and salvage this season.
After months of speculation, things are actually starting to happen. We have the draft lottery, and now players heading into their home cities. Their playing cities on top of that. Before we let you go, CJ, there is an anniversary today, 4 years ago, within 23 minutes, two of the biggest trades in recent NHL history went down. Taylor Hall for Adam Larsson and PK Subban for Shea Weber. It seems like those trades happened so long ago, but now when you look back 4 years, how do we look back at those trades? Is there one that really stands out to you and or a player that you look back and say, you know, you kind of reassess it differently now?
Well, probably the Canadiens trade. You know, I didn't think too highly of the return there just because, you know, Subban was a younger quantity, you know, and still at the top of his game. I mean, he had a great couple of years in Nashville, and we've sort of seen his play fall off a bit. And if anything, you know, I think Shea Weber this year, and I know he played through a pretty significant injury, you know, he looked like he's defying his age a little bit. And so, you know, that appeared to be a trade for the longest time, maybe even, you know, from this day 4 years ago for the next 2 years, where I think most people would have said Nashville came out on the better end. But, you know, I'm not quite so convinced of that now, which is, I guess, the beauty of sports is depending on when you're looking back on something, you know, it kind of changes the view. Well, that was a crazy day. And if I can offer a confession, because I feel like 4 years is safe enough, I was having an afternoon nap when that whole thing went down. And so I literally woke up as a, you know, a hockey journalist, you know, trying to usually be in on breaking these kind of things. And everything had happened. My timeline was chaos. My phone was chaos. And I felt pretty guilty at the time.
Don't tell me it was like a 25-minute nap and you just missed that 23-minute period altogether. Was it a power nap or was it like a good nap? Did you get your money's worth at least?
I think it was a good nap. And keep in mind that this time, normally, I've just come through covering the whole playoffs and all the travel and the draft and everything, and I was pretty exhausted, but still. I also believe Steven Stamkos signed with Tampa that day or indicated that wanted to sign or whatever. So anyway, like the three biggest hockey stories of the year happened within an hour and I was sleeping. So take with that what you will.
Hey, that's a great story though. CJ, I'm going to bring that up as often as I possibly can now. Thank you very much. And thanks for letting our listeners know about it as well. We'll talk next week.
All right, boys. Thanks for having me.